The interviewer gets interviewed coming right up.
ऐसी मशीन लगाऊंगा इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा.
Happy New Year, dear listener. Hope you had an amazing year ahead. And to do our bit towards making your year awesome, we've got a very special guest today. Someone who sprang a huge surprise on us, on the entire country, in fact, during New Year's. Of course, your host is no surprise to you. It's the great Bong himself. Welcome back, Arnab. Happy New Year and did you have a good one?
I did have a good Happy New Year, but my voice possibly, my throat is still stuck. In 2018, unfortunately, my vocal cords. So I haven't recovered from that horrible. So you guys heard that last time, and you'll possibly hear it this time too. So yes, without further ado, we have a very, very special guest. Actually, so the guest for today is Smita Prakash, editor at ANI. I know that, and I want to start off by, you know, with a disclaimer that we will not, in the course of this conversation, we will not be talking about the recent interview with the Prime Minister and the aftermath. In a way, I talked to Smita a while ago. I requested her to come on this show, and at that point of time, I didn't know that she was going to be interviewing the Prime Minister. So it was not really even in the nature of the conversation that I had kind of planned out for her. So just as a disclaimer, we will not be discussing anything about the interview or what happened after it or what led to it. So without further ado, thank you, Smita, for being a guest on my podcast.
Thank you, Arnab. Thank you, Vikram, for having me over. This is the first time that I'm doing a podcast, I think. An explanation as to why I don't want to speak about it, simply because, you know, after I did the interview, I just was very clear, all the channels and all the newspapers who wanted to talk to me about it. And I just said, I don't want to be the story. Let the interview be the story. I just didn't want to, you know, hog all the limelight. The person who gave the interview, he's the person. I just asked the question. So I just wanted to be out of all this and the controversy that came on later after that. So I just want to stay away from that. And that's why I said I don't want to speak about it, not just because I'm being picky and choosy. Yeah, so hi, I'm happy to be here. Go ahead, ask your question.
Okay, so this is the first question was something different, but I've changed it based on what you now just said. So without reference to the context, why do you feel in general that those who are covering the news should not become the news as a matter of principle?
Yeah, well, I'm still old school, Arnab, in my journalism, in the sense that I'm an agency journalist, and that's the difference between an agency journalist and a news channel journalist, where, you know, the news channel, I'm not saying that an agency journalist is better journalist or is more newsy, committed or any of that sort. None of those adjectives. What I'm trying to say is that when a news channel journalist does an interview, say an Acosta interview or a question, there's always the thing in the back of the mind that you need your ratings, you need it to be a spicy interview, masala interview, you need the person, the subject, to get excited and give this dhamakedar bite, or, you know, that kind of a thing. Whereas when an agency journalist does an interview, I need long answers, I need uninterrupted answers. I have clients, I have subscribers in Kohima, I have subscribers in Coimbatore, I have subscribers in Kashmir, I have subscribers in Kabul, I have subscribers all over the world. So the answers need to be something that a channel can use, that a newspaper can use. So, you know, everything that an agency journalist does is different from what a channel TV journalist does. This difference is extremely difficult to explain to a common man who says, "Arey, that one was, you know, like sharp shooting questions. Why didn't you interrupt? Why didn't you do question and answer where you're, you know, making the subject feel uncomfortable?" That's not my job. And I've never done that. I mean, I've been in this profession for 30 years. If you pick up any of my interviews, you know, dating back 25, 26 years, In fact, I wanted to tell Mr. Tharoor this also, who made some snide remark about the interview. I mean, if I was to dig out the interview that I did of his when he wrote a book, it was the same style where I just allowed him to speak about the book. I didn't tell him at that time, you're trying to get into politics. I know what you are doing. No, it wasn't that. I mean, I'm not into all that, you know. So everybody has a different style. That was my style.
Oh, that's actually, so explain this to me. I personally don't know this. So, you know, this is not just me asking a question for the sake of it, but you use the word agency. And I think many of our listeners, I know what an agency is, but could you explain what about an agency, being a part of agency, distinguishes you from somebody else?
Okay. So a news agency, like you have Reuters, you have AP, AFP. In India, there's PTI, there's UNI, there's ANI. So PTI is a print news agency, has subscribers across the country as well as abroad. Newspapers and websites who get news which they cover. For example, if a newspaper, say Deccan Chronicle, they operate out of Karnataka or Andhra Pradesh, or, you know, two or three states they have editions. Now, they will have just a very small bureau in Delhi. They will have maybe one reporter in Kolkata. So, can't cover the entire state of West Bengal with one person sitting in Kolkata. So you have PTI. PTI would have several bureaus across the country, and they will provide the news to all their subscribers. That is an agency's work. Mm-hmm. ANI, where I work, is television news agency, as well as print, as well as web, multimedia, everything. So we cover news across the country and in South Asia and provide it to our subscribers, who don't need to then have individual reporters. They pay a subscription. So all that ANI does is subscription-based. We are a B2B company. So all the news that we cover goes to our subscribers. Now, those subscribers can just pick our coverage as far as television is concerned, or our print service, whatever they want. They don't need to give us credit and say, "This is ANI." If they are nice enough, sometimes they do. They give us credit on air or in their print or in websites, and they use that coverage in whichever way they want, which is chop, copy paste, use paragraphs, say agency and quotas. It depends on whatever, but that's what an agency's job is as compared to a broadcaster or a newspaper.
Okay. So is there a subscription model? Do they have to subscribe to ANI or these agencies? Is that how you get paid in terms of, like,
correct.
How does the business model work?
Okay. Yes, it's a subscription-based model, Arnab. So what they do is that they pay us, and then they get the feed, which could come to them in various formats. Whether it is print, whether it is television, it's only subscription-based. Nothing comes without the subscription. They can't do a one-off deal where they get one coverage. Sometimes, yes. Like, for example, if there is a train accident, or if, you know, I mean, various stories which happen, there are times when foreign broadcasters say that we want this one-off coverage. We're not interested. I mean, if somebody sitting in Netherlands, for example, doesn't want to subscribe, may be subscribing to Reuters and hence gets ANI. Or, you know, but if they want a detailed coverage, say a presidential visit from X country, mm-hmm. they want a complete coverage, wall-to-wall coverage of their president's visit. In that case, then they subscribe to just that period when the president is here. So we make exceptions for foreign clients, yes.
Okay. So this is my first question that I had kind of thought that I would ask you, because I know that your beat is primarily political, right? I'm not wrong, am I? So what do you think makes a good political reporter? Let's forget good, because there's a kind of moral judgment implicit in it. What makes an effective political reporter?
one, to, you know, be as unbiased as possible, which is almost impossible in our scenario, to keep eyes and ears open when it comes to politics, because it's 24/7, and it is, because, you know, unlike in other countries where you have weekends, in India, there's nothing. I don't know whether you can hear behind me the Prime Minister speaking. So, you know, one channel out here is open where I've got, you know, half a year where I'm listening to whether he's going to be saying something which could become the news of the day. So it's in India, politics is all pervasive, and it is 24/7, 365 days of the year. So a political reporter's job just doesn't end. We don't work shift wise. And, you know, whatever your beat, you could be doing, like, for example, for many years, I did external services, which is like external affairs, which is like foreign beat. Now, even when you're doing foreign beat, you need to be aware of what is happening domestically. You need to be politically aware of what is happening as far as political parties are concerned, as far as politicians are concerned. So to be on the ball all the time is something that a political reporter has to do, and make sure that when you're covering a particular beat, you don't become part of that political party. You know, it becomes a tunnel syndrome, which I see many times when in my political beat reporters, is that when they start covering or they are stuck with one political party for more than 2 to 3 years, they start behaving like that political party's karyakarta. Like, you know, you just can't help it, I guess, because you're there for 12 to 14 hours in the party office. You start then spouting gyan like the politicians that you're interacting with. You know, getting too close to politicians is really not good, something that political party, political reporters need to guard against.
That's a very good thing, which is I wanted to work off that. So with respect to political reporting, you know, some political reporting is very research-based. So the political reporter kind of takes a hands-off approach, does a lot of research. And then there's some kind of political reporting which is access-based. They kind of come up with the news before it becomes news. And that is primarily driven by networks. Now, which one do you think is, again, more effective, better, even ethical? So I'm putting a few bombs here and there, but...
as an editor, I need both kinds. I need reporters on the field who have access, who can get me the bite immediately, who can get me the inside story. For example, see, today or yesterday in Uttar Pradesh, Akhilesh Yadav and not in Uttar Pradesh, but in Delhi, supposedly, but Uttar Pradesh politics, Akhilesh Yadav and Mayawati are supposed to have met and worked out a deal. Now, I need my access reporter to get me the information whether they really did meet, because all the stories that I'm reading today, all the reports are source-based stories. So these are clearly access journalists who have got the information that the two met and some kind of a deal has been worked out where they have kept the Congress party out of their Gathbandhan. Now, I need my access reporter to tell me. Now, the access reporter says that I don't have a formal response to this. This is gossip. This is not corroborated with facts, whether they have formed a Gathbandhan or not. So I have been put on hold. So as an agency, we have not put out the story whether this Gathbandhan has happened or not. So now do I berate my access journalist that you have not given me the story, or do I wait and watch and go with his advice or her advice of not going with the story? So I have decided on not going with the story. So we have not filed it. We are probably the only ones who have not filed the story, because I still give I give importance to my ground reporter. I don't get pushed too much by competition in this respect. Comes the other one about research and basing it not on access journalism. That kind of long-form journalism, that kind of space and time of research-based journalism, unfortunately has taken a beating in today's world where everything has to be quick and fast. There are outlets who we as agency provide news to who don't carry this breaking news kind of format. They do their long-form, and all due respect for them, but that market is shrinking. Advertising to that market is shrinking too.
So with this, with my concern as a consumer of news, again, I've not been associated with the news media to any extent at any point of my life. But for me as a consumer of news, I'm always a little worried about access journalism because, first of all, I understand that the politician knows that they're providing access. So there is always this, well, are we being told what they want us to hear? Number one. And number two, does the fact that I gave you something, does that necessarily lead to some expectation of quid pro quo that, okay, sometimes I need, you to reciprocate. So that would mean suppressing news or, giving it a spin. So that's always this problem with access journalists. Do you feel that, do you agree or do you think that that's really me as an outsider saying things I don't understand?
No, I totally agree with you, Arnab. I totally agree with you. It is a problem. Traditionally in India, access journalism is what journalism was all about for a long, long time. It's changing a little bit, yes. It's a pushback, naturally. But yes, there are pitfalls. When you get access, when you're given access, you're expected to sometimes suppress news, sometimes to color news. I don't deny that. And all political parties do it. And they do it not just at the center level. They do it at the state level. They do it at the really grassroots level, especially during elections. If a particular politician, I'll give you an example. When I was covering, say, Bihar elections, I'm not going to tell you which election it was, which year, but when I was covering Bihar election, there was this really celebrated politician, celebrated journalist, and he was on the flight, on the private plane of the top politician of the day, and he was going from one place to the other in that aircraft. So he was covering Bihar election from so many points just because he had access to the aircraft with that politician. Then he also had a car provided by that political party to travel in and around the area, right? He also, because that politician gave the car, he also gave him free electricity access at many places to the OB vans, that is the broadcast vans. Now, in comparison, many of us who were traveling and covering the same election had to pay for our own car, which means lakhs of rupees. It costs a lot to travel in India, hiring a car, hiring a stringer who will take you around. So you hire the car. You obviously cannot cover from so many locations because you don't have chopper or you don't have aircraft facility and you can't afford it. Nobody has that kind of budget to pay for, flying from one place to the other to cover elections. So we didn't have that. Then comes electricity, things you take for granted in foreign countries. In India, it's access to electricity is also something that is controlled. Now, yes, it is better. But at that time, when that election was happening, Bihar did not have electricity all that much 24 hours, which means hiring a generator set. So this is how politicians control media. The backstory which people don't know about the media, how we get pulverized when we are covering elections. So these are things which happen. Yes, access journalism has its negativity. And I just illustrated one point to you, Arnab.
So this is very interesting. So again, this journalist, I'm not particularly interested about that journalist or that election, but as a point for me to understand, is it because this journalist was ideologically affiliated with said politician, or would he then go to, when he was covering another state election, do the exact same thing with a politician of a different persuasion if they gave him free electricity and, gave him like private plane access? Or do kind of politicians know that this guy is that party, so I'll just avoid him like the plague?
It works both ways. There are some journalists who will bend backwards in pleasing a politician, regardless of which political party that person is. Those kind of access journalists have access across the board, and I don't blame them in the sense that that's the way journalism is in, or they're fated. They will get lax as salary. They will be asked to join X channel, Y newspaper. So, you know, I don't know where, at what point of time your ethics come into play because all said and done, they are getting the news story. They are getting the one-on-one with that politician. Now, when they do the interview and they do the cross-questioning, maybe they are not soft while they're doing the questioning. Maybe they're not soft in doing their reporting. So I don't completely blame journalists because, you know, all said and done, they do get access in all these places. And that's the only way to do journalism in many of the states that we're talking about. Because if you don't have access, you can't get into Raj Bhavan or you can't get into the Vidhan Sabha. You can't get into those places to cover elections. So, you know, you're stuck with this in a kind of a system where access journalism is the only journalism in many places that's available. Now, are they the only ones who are successful? Not true. I mean, people push and get their way, even if they don't get that access with a politician. I mean, today, or you know, you're not today. Literally, you can't get into government offices. You can't get into ministers' offices like you used to in the early days. Despite that, journalists are doing their work. So, it has its minuses and pluses.
So you said people can't get into offices nowadays. Can you explain a little bit why do you think that is the case? Is it because
I knew you'd pick on that.
Let me guess. Is it because of the ubiquitous nature of small recording devices?
No, not so much. I think BJP, when they came in to power, you know, there was this mindset that Delhi journalists, it began with Mr. Modi saying that journalists are news traders and the entire profession had been given this color that, you know, there was too much of access journalism, which you use the word to, which is happening in Delhi. So basically all that journalists are doing is sucking up to the powers. So there was this crackdown by the BJP government on access that journalists had. So politicians wouldn't meet journalists. So and then the babus, the official dumb, they get their cues from politicians. So they wouldn't meet with journalists. And then only with a few journalists that they were comfortable with. And yes, everybody is scared of being recorded. So, you know, where you could just call up a politician and ask him, "Bhai, gadbandhan ho raha hai ki nahi? Aap kisse mile the? Kya aap Akhilesh se mile the?" Now they don't talk on the phone because everybody records everything.
Exactly.
Right. So they don't speak on the phone. They don't, if they meet you, then they're scared that they're being recorded by their bosses. So it's every political party now, they're just scared of meeting with journalists. And then social media has changed all the equation. If somebody wants to speak to people, they just put it out there on Twitter or Facebook, you know. So he said, well, why do we need to go through this via media?
Right, exactly. As you know, one of my favorite things is Bollywood and Hindi movies. So you're absolutely right. The same thing happened with movie journalism. So before social media, the movie journalists were really the only ways that the Bollywood stars had of connecting with their fan base. So that's why the movie journalists were very, very powerful. And they also had their, you know, models of access and belonging to camps. And they were very, very powerful, you know, Filmfare and Stardust. And with social media, I mean, that industry essentially died out because now stars, they just talk directly to their fans over social media. They don't need that medium. And I know that there was this huge problem with Amitabh Bachchan once because, you know, he didn't get the coverage that he wanted. So he kind of went off media for a decade or so. And, you know, then the media needed him. And then when he needed the media wasn't ready to talk to him when his lot was down. So, I mean, I guess that we perhaps in politics, we are kind of following that, you know, politicians are going directly to their bhakts.
Yeah, Instagram and the film stars have used Instagram very well, I think. All those pictures that you see, you know, they're there all over Instagram. They're there on Facebook. They're using Twitter. They have teams doing it. I mean, all those beautifully worded tweets and Facebook, I doubt whether they have the time to do all that on their own. So quite a few of them have teams which are doing their social media interactions. That's become a new job profile also, you know, to work on social media teams of film actors and actresses. So they've used that very well. The only time that they now come to mainstream media is when their film promotions are being done. Right. So that the cue that politicians are getting is a lot. And Mr. Modi was one of the first, I think, who started with using social media as a direct connect with people rather than going through mainstream media, because he felt, I think before 2013, he just felt that mainstream media has given him a raw deal and they come with preset notions. He said this in all the interviews that he gave in 2013 and 2014, before the run-up to the elections, that I don't need you guys. I can do it without you. I go directly to the people, whether through his campaigning or whether he was, you know, on social media. So he just kind of laid the prototype out there about interacting directly with the people. And when you speak to people, you know, on the ground, when you go there and say, Modi ji interview nahi dete, press conference nahi dete, people like, you think I care? I don't give a damn. Tumko nahi dete, toh kya hua? You know, they don't care. As far as they are concerned, they are getting Modi on their WhatsApp. They're getting Modi in their Facebook. They're getting Modi in Twitter. They're getting what they want. So they don't care that wo press conference nahi dete. This is just media which gets worked up that Modi press conference nahi dete, you know. So I think using social media is something, of course, it's bad for business as far as journalists are concerned. I think that to a large extent, media also has to do some introspection as to how we went wrong, that, you know, there is no trust about the media, whether it is politicians, whether it's officials, or whether it's just common people. You know, just we need to think about it all over again. It's not just politicians attacking us all the time. I mean, it's not what's happening in America. It's, if you collate that and say that, oh, you know, this is the Trump way of doing it, throw the media under the bus. No, that's completely different. Indian media story is also different. So I'm ready to introspect and say that somewhere we made a mistake in the way we were interpreting events which were happening, which is why people don't empathize much with us when we crib and complain that we don't have access.
Mm-hmm. It's good that you brought up Trump, because I was actually going to say that that what Trump does is an extreme version of what Modi does, in the sense that his attacks on mainstream media are much more virulent or much more violent. And at least Modi's tweets are all curated tweets. They're not like the kind of unhinged tweets that Trump does. And people like to use the word unhinged, but you know, I feel that they're carefully done, because what Trump does with his tweets is he totally takes over the conversation. So even if you have the comedy shows, which are very much against him, but they will spend about 2 minutes on their half an hour, well-watched half an hour discussing his tweet. Now, there is no way that he would be on the nightly news setting the agenda if it wasn't for the tweets. There's no other way that I can think of. So I think that in this day and age, and we are not there yet in India, I would say, but I think at least in the US, since, you know, I'm being in this country, I consume a lot of US news, which I necessarily don't always want to, but I prefer Indian news. But I think Trump has taken it to an extreme in terms of the kind of attacks he periodically does against, especially CNN, but other news, in other news organizations also. And he does it for the effect. He knows that the base loves it, that they lap it up. I mean, he just doesn't do it.
Absolutely. They just love it. You know, because the night that Trump won the election, we were there. I was there covering it. And I think there were just two or three reporters left in front of the Trump hotel. The others had all gone towards the Hillary camp, you know, because she had this huge event which she had organized. So all the Indian reporters were there. Uh-huh. And I had the choice. So what I did was that I said, no, you know, everybody's covering Hillary because she is supposed to win. Let me go to the loser camp and see what happens there. you know, I always like to do the story which nobody else is doing. So I said, let me go there. And there were just three of us, I think, three or four of us. One was Turkish TV, that I know for certain. And one was me and two others, you know, like print reporters or something, just standing around in the cold, you know, just looking and saying, my goodness, this is what a loser camp looks like, because there was nobody. And, you know, it was so cold. And then slowly, you know, the dogs came in, the police came in, and, you know, the mahal started changing. And then I got a call from Delhi and saying that, no, no, don't move towards the Hillary camp. This is where the story is. It seems to be turning. And sure enough, you know, the noise started off. So I said, no, 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 I want to go and see now how Hillary is reacting to that. Because here, the story had started that, okay, he's on a winning spree. So I went there, I saw people crying, I reported on that, then came back to the Trump hotel, because there I had the pass, access pass. And so we entered and there was NDTV and me. We were the only two news, Indian news channels, teams which were allowed inside, because we are the only ones who applied for access to the Trump headquarters. So we went in out there and, you know, we saw how the people were clapping away when Trump criticized the media, and he looked towards us where we were standing and he ridiculed us, and there was so much of clapping, and quite a few people were drunk at that time in the audience, and, you know, his supporters, and they came up and said, see, see, see what he did to you. You deserved it, you know. And I was like, oh my God, I can just well imagine what 4 years are going to be for the media out here. I'm so glad I'm going back to my own country. But we came back to India. We get the same thing out here too. When we go out there covering elections, there are many people who say, you had this coming. You had this coming. You people were thinking too much of yourselves. You needed a reality check. So, okay, fine. I mean, this is the period that we are going through where some kind of course correction is happening. Yes, we are not there where America and Trump is, but then social media has been the biggest leveler. To some extent, you know, I was just watching the other day Ellen's show, and I think Whoopi was on that show, and she was saying that nobody wants to host the Oscars because they're just scared of the backlash that they're going to get on social media. As soon as you go there as an, you know, on stage, within seconds, people put out there, are you funny? You think you're funny? You're not funny. You're this, you're that. And it's the same thing on social media. I'm sure you get that too, Arnab, that when you do your podcast or when you do your tweets, people call back and say, are you think you're funny? And that's the worst thing, when you put out a tweet which you think is funny, where people turn around and say, you're not funny. That's the most awful thing.
Having been on social media for way too long, criticism is inherent. I cannot recollect even one thing that I've ever done which hasn't led to some form of criticism. And as I've been writing my blog since 2004, since from 2005, a persistent comment that I have gotten is that the quality of your writing has been going down. From 2005 down to 2018. So for 13 years, it has been going down. I wonder what it was in 2004. But unfortunately, nobody commented then. And I didn't know how great. And nobody knew how great I was, because I've been going down for 13 years. But I think that was actually a question that I had. But we all know that this exists. I know it exists. But for me, I'm not a journalist. And I mean, if I stay silent for a year, nothing really is going to happen to me. Of course, I won't be able to stay silent for a year. That's another thing. But do journalists feel intimidated by, like, they know that the moment I'm going to do this that there is going to be a reaction to it. That, you know, we know beforehand that this one is going to get a rise out of this set of social media users. Now, we know that. But does that affect the way a journalist does his or her work, or the way they message it, now that there is that instant, mostly negative feedback? While in the olden days of journalism of AMJ Akbar, I can't even mention the name nowadays, but, you know, in that day, because I grew up in Calcutta, where AMJ Akbar was like the name of, like, what a great journalist should be like. So in those days, nobody told AMJ Akbar that, okay, you know, this piece wasn't that great, or you've lost your ability to write English. We could never say that to him. So of course he wasn't affected by it. But now our journalists, especially those, you know, like you, who were so much in the public limelight, Do you feel yourself pressurized, intimidated by the reaction that is going to follow?
Okay. So several points. One, what you said about MJ. When I started journalism in Delhi, it was Arun Shori. Right. Many of us thought, oh, you know, with this whole thing that he was doing on taking on powers that be. So many of us had our heroes. MJ, I liked his style of writing. That's it. But not beyond that. For me, it was Arun Shori at that time that I got into journalism because of that. So, slowly what happens is when you're in the profession, your heroes, you realize that they have feet of clay. So you decide, no more heroes. No woman, no man is worth idolizing in journalism. So your mentors, you see them up close and you realize, it's like interviewing a film star or not. I mean, if I was to go back to Bollywood, I used to really, really idolize one or two actors. And the worst thing I ever did was meet them and interview them. Because then you realized, oh my God, the screen image and the reality is so different. So, no heroes. Now comes whether, as you put in more years in journalism, you develop a thick skin, unfortunately. You know, you become immune to criticism. Some people, you become immune to criticism, and that is bad. I feel you shouldn't be. If you are not sensitive to what your readers are telling you, then I think it's like an artist, you know. If you go on stage and you're not responsive to your audience, then what are you? You just are somebody who thinks so much of himself that I'm so great, it doesn't matter to me what my audience thinks. So I think somewhere journalists, some people at least, remain sensitive and did course correction when they realized that, oh my God, what I was doing, this milieu that I was in, and I was seeing things through these glasses. I think especially for me, stayed left of center for a long period of my life, turned more and more centrist in my profession. Why? Because also got, you know, when social media opened up, you got to meet virtually in virtual world, you got to meet people and it opened up your eyes, because in real life, maybe you didn't interact with so many people in that sphere. When I met you, I think I met you about 10 years ago, yes. I think in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Right. And I, you know, till then I kept thinking that Modi topi kyun nahi pehen sakta, jab sab topi pehen sakta, wo Musalman ki topi kyun nahi pehen sakta, you know, and then you put that idea into my head that why does he need to wear a topi to say he's, you know, he appreciates Islam or Muslims or whatever. Why is that topi so important? Topi is something, now this is something that even Modi has said, but when you said it, it just like, okay, why not? I thought about it. Then I talked about it to other people. So, you know, what happens is that if you are so, you think that you know it all, and like a random person you might meet puts this idea on your head and you think, are ye politician thod na, isko kya pata hai? Ye journalist thod na, isko kya pata hai? You know, that attitude I never wanted to be in me. Somebody else has it, fine. Their journalism prospers. My journalism is not about that. That is why I still remain a reporter. I still go and do my stories, because if I lose that connection with what people think, whether it's an author, whether it's a doctor, a laborer, you know, a shoemaker, anybody, I need to have that connect with people to understand that the journalism I'm doing is right or wrong or insensitive or elitist or whatever, to guard against that. So, journalists, they have modified. Many of them think like I do. I'm not an exception. Many of them have got intimidated because of reactions that come on social media, but have become sensitive to what they write. And it has impacted on our journalism.
This has been extremely interesting, Smita. I can't wait for Arnab to continue the interview, but a quick word from our sponsors and then we'll be right back. And of course, now we are back, and over to you, Arnab.
So another question that I had, this was a conversation that I had with somebody who was a journalist this time or the last time that I went to Calcutta. So he was telling me about a certain incident which happened in Calcutta where there was effectively a communal riot-like situation, which according to him should have been big news. But the newspapers next day, there was absolutely no news except the people who were there in Calcutta and who actually saw what was going on and who were affected by it. So the reason why he said was that the editors basically took a decision that there is no good that can come from saying what happened, and this would create communal tension, and you would have realized what kind of event we are talking about. And this is not an isolated case. I mean, I read articles, and I see that in some cases we see a redaction of the names because it would give out the religion, and sometimes we do have some places where names and religions aren't mentioned, and because they are mentioned, they get into different kind of hate trackers, and sometimes they aren't. And I often wonder as an outsider, why? Is it because the bad part of me says, wants to think that they're all biased, so they're obviously doing this because they have a bias and they want to, you know, create a narrative. But then there's also another part of me which wants to look at it from another side. Maybe they're not bad people. Maybe they just feel that they have, that if they say what the truth is unvarnished, that it might lead to other problems. So they feel they have a social responsibility. And maybe it's coming from a good place. So how do you resolve that conundrum yourself?
One, there are some laws that you can't write when there is a situation on. You won't go on air to say, a Hindu temple was vandalized or use the word that, you know, and I think animal carcass found in a place of worship is what it is the words that we'd use. We won't say pig thrown into a mosque. So these are the words that we use in reporting. Sometimes even that is not said, depending on the situation. If it's an ongoing riot, if it is an ongoing situation where the police hasn't reached, where the curfew has not yet been imposed, and we know and we're getting pictures, we'll hold it. We do this as a regular thing in Jammu and Kashmir. We hold back visuals, even which we might have about action which is taking place, police action, army action. We hold it. We do a deferred telecast. Sometimes there are 8-hour deferring it for 8 hours, sometimes 3 hours. We won't do it till we know for certain that the authorities have the area in control, and warnings have been issued out to adjoining areas to ensure that riots don't take place. This is just to save lives. So I am perfectly fine as far as my news organization is concerned in deferring news. I'm not interested in breaking news which could complicate the situation on the ground when lives might be lost and public property damaged. That having said, will newspapers kill a story, maybe the same reasons that they're killing stories about riots. We still are not in a position where people deal with these things with maturity. If I was to put out the story that a cow head has been found inside a temple, it will inflame passions. Till such a time that our country is in a situation where inter-religious, inter-caste riots don't take place, till such a time, it's fine in my book, by news organizations to stop breaking news of that kind.
But I understand if there is a fine line where you feel that there is a risk of immediate retaliation. But I often find, and again, maybe this is my own biases speaking, but I often find that certain kinds of crime, like for instance, for Pehlu Khan. Nobody would say that an individual, and then they will not mention the kind of animal. It would absolutely be, I personally like it because I feel that I deserve the truth. So if there is a communal angle, please do mention the communal angle because that's really what the crime is. But then there are some other crimes that I've often seen where, you know, one news agency does not report the name. And another news agency does report the name. And then you wonder why this other guy just decided to kind of keep the name out of it. You understand, we're reading the context, why it is the case. Yeah. So it comes out, but
I totally get it. Yeah. Yeah, it's also because, see, as in mainstream media, we are bound by certain laws and rules. Then there is the web journalists who have literally no laws against them. They put all kinds of things on the net and they don't get into trouble. We will, as broadcasters, as agency journalists, as accredited journalists to Government of India, we will get into trouble if we put it out. Whereas websites, they put out all kinds of so journalists working on websites. They don't have these kind of, pabandi. They kuch bhi dal do, kisi ke baare mein bhi likh do. Nobody comes after them. Whereas for us, we will. One, we do this kind of self-censorship, which I talked about, correcting yourself and being responsible. Websites don't have that. They need to break in somehow or the other, so they will name. No, we won't do that. I mean, it depends from, organization to organization. So you'll see most mainstream media journalists and reporters in their, even if they put it out on their Twitter feed, personal Twitter handle, their reports will not be carried by the newspapers or their newspaper websites or their channels till such an extent that till such a time that their editors okay it.
Okay. So given, and we had an interesting discussion with Harini on this in a previous podcast, but do you think that given the fact that there is pretty much online, there is no subscription model anymore, with some exceptions like the Ken Web, and we've moved to a purely advertiser-driven model, both in terms of the net and the television. Do you think, is it even okay to even expect journalistic integrity? Like, if I expect journalistic integrity, isn't the joke really on me at this point of time? If I'm accepting an advertiser-driven model, to expect that people will not be affected by that?
I don't know. I don't want to be that cynical, Arnab, to say that just because it's an advertising driven model, there's no integrity in journalism, to some extent it does get colored. But I just give you an example. Switch on the television, most channels are getting ads from, say, one Ambani group or the other Ambani group. But are you seeing any channel not running the Rafal story? They're all running it, right? So, and they're all talking about Anil Ambani. They're all talking about Rahul Gandhi's statement that that PM favored Ambani. So even though they're getting ads from one Ambani or the other, they're running it. So I don't think just because it's advertisers are advertising on a particular channel, to that extent, then micromanaging the editorial content, very few websites and very few news channels and newspapers allow that kind of interference by advertisers. Yeah, to some extent, there will be interference. And some websites who might be desperate for advertising because they are otherwise shutting down, they might make those compromises. But I think readers, subscribers, they are all very aware. They know immediately and they stop viewing that channel. They stop reading that newspaper. And they realize that ye to bika hua hai, as they keep saying in social media, ye to bik chuka hai. So I think integrity of a news integrity is something that that will stay, I hope at least.
But everybody says that the opposite side to bik chuka hai. That's what I say, everybody. So that's a common thing. Everybody has been sold out by everybody else. If I don't agree with you, you're sold out.
That's true.
And I saw a tweet where somebody said, if you aren't sold out and you're this, and if you haven't taken money for what you're saying, then I have an even a poorer idea of you, which I found was very funny. If I'm doing this for free. So yeah, I give it to him for, yeah, you made me laugh. True. Perhaps even more pathetic than I think I am.
That's true.
If I'm doing this for free. But so.
That's true. In fact, in one of the comments that was that I saw on television by this politician, who said that, the fact that Mr. Modi took the questions which seemingly were antagonistic, but he answered them, goes to show that the antagonistic question had been framed and he had approved. You know how that person twisted himself? don't make that kind of a comment. So it's interesting, you know, how people will come to these kind of conclusions. Theek hai, chalega, bolte rao.
So, see, these days, you know, within quote-unquote of citizen journalism and all, I have a phone in, and immediately I think that I'm a journalist, right? So, what I want to ask you is, do you think there's a need to educate people or, you know, make people aware of the need for qualified journalists as opposed to reporters?
Yeah, this now this WhatsApp school of journalism bhi to hai. So, you know, Vikram, you know, yeah, I mean, what do I have to say? My mother is one of the biggest consumers of WhatsApp journalism. You know, like she'd say, I heard this happen. So I'm like, where did you hear it? Where did you see it? You know, there are marble chips in rice and there is, you know, washing powder in milk and all these things. You know, everybody sitting at home now is a journalist and they're forwarding. Even if they don't believe
forward karne mein kya jata hai.
So everybody is forwarding it and then the worst is forwarded as received. You know, I mean, no responsibility at all. So forwarded as received and you just like, so jokes are over and it's like WhatsApp journalism. And if you think that that's harmless, no, it's terribly harmful. I'm telling you, half the time in the office, the editors are like constantly fact-checking to see which person on the ground, which reporter on the ground has done a particular story because of this, you know, viral video that he would have got that yahan pe ye hua, wahan pe ye hua, chase that story. And it may not have happened. But, you know, when he gets it from 5-6 people, he said, oh, it might have happened. So, you know, half the time of the editors on the desk is to find out and fact check to see that none of this is WhatsApp journalism, which has seeped its way somehow into our news feed. So checking all that it's an extremely dangerous trend. It's good in a way, for example, that when that accident happened, that railway accident that happened, there were, you know, several angles from which people had shot that on their phone. So, you know, everybody knew what actually happened. So no politician or no organizer out there could say that humne to logon ko bola tha dur khade hone ke liye. No, everybody knew because of that citizen journalism at that point, everybody knew what had happened and the organizers had screwed up. The politician knew when she came there that this is what had happened, that she... people were dangerously close to the railway track. She did not use the podium. The organizers didn't use the podium. So, you know, because of cell phones being around at that time, everybody knew. Similarly, when politicians say all kinds of bizarre things on stage, which can result in, you know, major law and order issues, they think that just because there's a TV camera not around, they can say those things, not realizing that there are people with cell phones now and it's got on camera. So people have become more wary now. So there are pluses and minuses to that citizen journalism.
But the sad thing is that this was, and I mentioned this in a previous podcast, that at least in Bengal, I don't know how it is in other places in India, but, you know, political rallies, speeches are very, very abusive, very abusive. That's why people come to hear them. And that's why, at least in Bengal, they get all these television and movie actors because they do good dialogues and, you know, you like to listen to them. And now,
but that was okay, no? Or no? When just before a politician spoke, you got the others to come and do the opening. Right, no, right. You got stand-up artists to come, and you got you know, people to come and sing and dance and all. But now, what has happened is that the politicians are expected to become stand-up artists.
Yes.
So they say all kinds of bizarre things. They say ridiculous stuff at rallies so that news ban jaye kisi tarah.
Yes, so that's another important thing.
Ridiculous. Even the press conferences have become like that, where you try to get a laugh out of your audience. So, you know, the seriousness of it is all gone because jab tak tum kuch bizarre nahi bologe, TV channel chalayega nahi. TV channel chalayega nahi, to newspaper mein chapega nahi. Newspaper mein chapega nahi. So it's a whole circle, you know.
A day ago or so, some BJP MLA said that if you were scared of staying in this country, I'll kill you or something. Which,
so that's what now I'm saying. Boito,
now he's famous. This is, of course, a supremely funny thing to say. It's almost like he was a stand-up comedian when he said it, but he said it in all seriousness. So
now go to Pakistan. If you say it, it won't go, na? Too many people have said go to Pakistan. So then you say something else.
So do you think the news media is, in a way, in a way encouraging this, because they're pushing the fringe. Nowadays, you need to stretch the envelope on both sides. Everybody needs to, like Rahul Gandhi now needs to give a wink. He needs to do all that stuff, which I don't think, you know, a generation of politicians before him would have done that. I can't visualize Narasimha Rao sitting there and winking at someone or just going there and, you know. But that those things are done, I'm guessing, for the amount of social media and television conversation that it will bring about. In which case, it was very successful, of course.
Yeah, so see, after 2.5 hour speech of Nirmala Sitharaman, defense minister, like you'd expect that would be the news, right? Three-day debate on Rafal and 2.5 hour speech by the defense minister. But immediately what happened was that the wink took over.
Right. Winking again.
Right? So this is what happens. This criticism, I think, is happening even in the US, where they're saying that, you know, big news stories, they get derailed with the tweets of Trump. You know, there might be something horrible that might be happening in the country or something phenomenal, you know, when it comes to foreign policy or whether it comes to domestic issues. But one tweet where he says something about a woman's looks, that becomes the big news story of the day just because. So he was leading the news cycle because of his tweets, and which was early morning tweets. Yeah. So, you know, this is what happened. And yesterday it was like very frustrating that wink became. I mean, it's his mannerism. He's going to do it. You know, he's not going to restrict himself. He's not going to behave like a Narasimha Rao. That's not him. He's going to do that. So the same way as, you know, each politician, when Modi came in as prime minister, it was like, why does he need to campaign so much? Why does he need to make these kind of political statements? Why? Because for 10 years, we had a non-politico as a prime minister. So it was like, why does Modi have to talk like this about Tharoor? Why does Modi have to make statements on Sonia Gandhi? Why does he have to do the politics? Why not leave it to Amit Shah to do that? Why does he have to do it? He should behave like a prime minister. That's not him. He is a politico. He is a political prime minister, unlike the 10 years where you had a non-political prime minister, which was Manmohan Singh. And the political work was done by the others. So, you know, things are different. So Rahul Gandhi, to expect him to behave in a particular manner, that's not going to happen. He's going to do what he's going to do, which is wink, which is make these, you know, strange remarks that he's doing these days. I don't know whether it is because he's being tutored to do that, to be more accessible and chummy with journalists, but that's his style.
I think, at least this is my hypothesis. Again, I've said this before in my podcast, but I think that this is, rather than be that, I think that people don't want a prime minister who's traditionally prime ministerial, or people in the US don't want a president who's considered to be presidential. I think that in this day and age, they want divisive figures. I think we see that across the world in the kind of politicians, the Argentinian premier, for instance, and the kind of tweets he has done. That this is not a question of people being as they are, but people cultivating a very specific hardline image. Because I think hardline now works on social media. You know, normalcy, being normal human being, just is not interesting. So you either have your, fan base kind of coalescing around your very provocative statements, and also you have those people who hate you also coalescing around you, and you like that. So Ocasio-Cortez, for instance, on the Democrat side, I mean, she has her own style, but I think everybody, she has, does her Instagram thing, she does like shopping, she has her own style. I read a very nice article which contrasted her social media to Hillary Clinton's, because Hillary Clinton's was very artificial, because she's just not a child of the social media age, but Ocasio-Cortez is so natural with it. I think, and I might be wrong, but I think Rahul Gandhi has changed, and it's not a spontaneous change. I think he's been told to change. I think in 2012, he often came across as kind of not being there. I mean, he didn't have any personality. He was always somebody who stumbles, I think, speech-wise in a George W. Bush way. But he kind of left it at that. So all you got was him stumbling and mumbling and just looking back, you know, blankly in different places. But over the years, I've seen kind of a good change in him, in the sense that he's, with his wink, I think he's trying to establish some kind of personal style, that that's his style. And that is, again, we're discussing it right now, right? We've spent 5 minutes discussing it. Before that, the only thing that we were discussing was, you know, something wrong he said, or, you know, but we're not laughing at him any longer. We are discussing him in a positive way. We're discussing a trait of him, his winking. Now, we're not laughing at it. I think this has been a big move, that Rahul Gandhi is moving from being the, you know, the punchline of a joke to somebody who can be considered as somebody you hate. Maybe you can hate him now much more because he comes across as this very arrogant, you know, prep school kind of boy. But I think it's cultivated. I don't think it just suddenly happened. He's too old for that, even though he's a youth icon, to suddenly change.
Yeah. I kind of agree with what you're saying. I mean, have you noticed also how George W. Bush's stumbling and fumbling style is now looked upon endearingly by the media, which used to make fun of him?
Now he's a hero. Once you see Donald Trump, you miss him. Because at least he was a gentle, conservative.
So you tell me now the media's credibility, the same media, you know, which laughed at him when it, I mean, it was the same thing when during, maybe not Obama, but maybe before that also. I mean, when Reagan era, when he was forgetting, when he was fumbling, when he was tilting over, everybody laughed at him that he wasn't aware of what was going on. Iran-Contra, he didn't know. Later got to know what the problem was, that there was Alzheimer's and there was all that which was happening. So that became, he became the hero. Then was George W. Bush. He was laughed at. There were memes made on him. I mean, the word meme probably wasn't there at that time. But all kinds of things, a joke, the same media. And now today when he hands over a chewing gum or something to Michelle Obama, he becomes this cute guy. At a funeral, hands over something and he becomes a cute guy for the same media. Why? Because they're comparing him to Trump. So if you see that, the same way that today, you know, three channels laughed at Rahul Gandhi winking and, you know, making these snide remarks where he said that about journalists, about politicians, when he says all this, there are some who say that this is, you know, loosening up of Rahul Gandhi, where he's decided he doesn't want to be stuffy, which, like, many people are saying that. And there are others who are critical that this is an image makeover, which is not the reality. This is an image makeover to make him seem accessible before the 2019 elections, as opposed to a stuffy prime minister that we have now in Modi. So who knows what the reality is, because both the leaders are so protected by their minders.
Right. Do you think that the Congress social media presence has become much better, and their messaging and everything? I mean, we all know that the BJP had a first mover's advantage, and then AAP came in, and Congress was always like the grand old party, was always slow off the blocks. But now, do you think it's caught on, or do you think they still don't get it?
The Congress Party?
Yes, the Congress Party.
Well, they came in late, as you mentioned, and they have their hits and misses just like BJP does. But strangely, the BJP Twitter handles, they're sounding so stuffy as compared to what they were. Like, most people are saying, ye to boring maal hai. Ye to bahut hi, you know, like stuffy, like ban nahi rahi baat. And that's why Rahul Gandhi, because his Twitter feed is getting more and more followers, because basically social media is also, you know, attacking power.
Yes.
So when you are in power, you have to be officious, and that's boring.
Right.
So when you attack powers that be, it's fun. People like to see kichad uchhalna, and they're seeing that, which is coming up from Rahul Gandhi. He doesn't do a follow-up. He'll just kichad uchhalo and run, then kichad uchhalo next day. And that's fun for people in social media. That's what's happening.
Right. I remember when Congress was in power, more than the BJP, I think the more effective messaging came from Unreal Times, or came from faking news at that point of time. I mean, they carried the most trenchant and, using humor, of course, the most trenchant takedowns of UPA too. And over the years, and that's absolutely right, where you're in the government, you no longer have the privilege of that. I think the has moved more than the Congress. The problem with BJP is that, I'd mentioned this again in the previous podcast, is that much of their messaging comes from branded pages like We Love Namo. I mean, come on, the moment you say We Love Namo, anything you say is already, we already know what it's going to be, right? But I think the Congress, I'm not saying that the Congress is working with them, but the opposition from stand-up comedians, and they're producing good content. So if you look at Being Human, I mean, they're funny content. They're doing good video, and Congress is using it. They don't need to do it. They could just like RT or forward it or use it in their pages, but it's not Congress branded content. If it's Congress branded, nobody's listening. Nobody cares.
Nobody really knows who's making this content, but it's coming out so fast and furious, whether it is from the Congress or the BJP. The videos that are quickly out on, I don't know. I mean, I just feel quite amazed. And also the social media teams of both the parties, they're huge. They're really, really big. And they are pretty amazing in how many people they have, how many WhatsApp groups they have infiltrated, how many people they have met up with. Thousands and thousands of WhatsApp groups have been infiltrated by the social media teams. And I'm not exaggerating. In all the states, in across the country, and they have stand-up comedians also with them, you know, like agreeing to their ideology and hence pushing forth those videos, or else, being part of the team. So just like many in the mainstream media, many in social media have become influencers because they believe in the ideology, or because they are getting some kind of benefits, access there to those politicians, access to those political parties or whatever. So I don't know whether it is that that creative for the sake of being creative.
So what you're saying is interesting. So what you're saying is it's not that it's just a happy confluence of ideas that, you know, that comedians are against the government in general and the Congress is against the government of naturally. It's more strategic. It's more...
Comedians are always right. Comedians by nature have to be against authority. How can comedians side with the government in power? Because then that's not fun, right? I mean, in any country, stand-up artists have to take on the powers that be, and thank God for
but
that.
But here's the problem. The problem is that the BJP in this case isn't universally in power. So when we're saying power, we're kind of assuming it's at the center. But for instance, there are other political parties which are in power at the state where they often have, and somehow making fun of them is not considered anti-establishment. For instance, in Bengal, if you go to Bengal, making fun of Mamata Banerjee is not considered anti-establishment. Making fun of Modi is considered anti-establishment, even though the establishment is Mamata Banerjee, and even though the most likely person you would fear in Bengal is Mamata Banerjee. So that, for me, I find it really amusing. Okay. They don't think that...
Yeah, interesting. Okay, I didn't see it in that respect. Yes, interesting. Yes.
So, and again, as Congress comes to power in these several states, I mean, one of the problems that BJP was suffering from, and that's one of the good things about losing elections, is that you don't have both the state and the center. So now you can, of course, blame the other guy. So, but with this, but I'm since I love stand-up comedy and I consider myself to be a comedian, if not a stand-up comedian, of course I'm not, is that... That there might be more than just, you know, just anti-establishment on both sides, that there might actually be concrete outreach by political parties to influencers, whether they be, you know, whether they be comedians or YouTubers. So, I mean, that's another big thing nowadays. YouTubers, we're not even doing
comedy. I'm sure they will reach out, and this will happen. I mean, it will happen. I think, you know, like in Karnataka, I'm sure there are jokes being cracked on the coalition which is happening, and that's getting the chief minister quite riled up. Some of the jokes in the channels are on the coalition government. And here again, you know, the channel might be owned by a BJP minister, and that's why the jokes and the late night comedians are taking on the chief minister and the coalition there. So it is happening to some extent in the states, may not be happening in Kolkata. I'm not aware of the scene out there as far as the late night shows are concerned. But yeah, the media there is pretty sharply divided in West Bengal. And it is true that, you know, politicians crack down. In fact, the reporters quite often say that if we take one story, it doesn't, barely half an hour later, they get calls from the rival politicians saying that you ran the story without our angle. Now run a story with our angle also. Do an update. Right. So this is a constant thing which is
happening. So let me mention this. I think one of the things that people now is they applaud the Telegraph. They say the only newspaper that's like honest and like really taking on the government is Telegraph. Look at their takedown of Modi on the front page. Dude, that newspaper is coming out from Calcutta, man. That's not the opposition. That is the government. So I find that amusing when people forget that there are other governments than the central government, which actually have a greater impact on their daily lives, the amount of fear that they feel, or the opportunities that they have, that the state government is much more powerful in that respect than the central government. But I've always found that particularly amusing, especially when they say that about Telegraph, which is my hometown newspaper. Mm. Okay.
And also proprietors, yes. They play an important role.
Okay. Anyways, this was going to be my last question. So thanks a lot, Smita, for being on the program. And thank you for being so open about different things. It was great talking to you. I learned a lot. And, you know, thanks a lot.
Great speaking to you, Arnav. Great speaking to Vikram. Thank you so much for having me on this. And I hope I haven't bored people. We've spoken for what, almost an hour and a half now.
And that's been our podcast for today. Thank you so much, Smita. And apologies for making you drive all the way to your office. I hope it wasn't too far on a weekend. And please send in your feedback to appodcast@talkingstuff.net. And you can even send in your questions and comments to our WhatsApp number. That's 96525-7883. If you're outside India, of course, make sure to add the India code, which is +91. You can also send in your tech queries to the same number. That's again 96525-STUFF. And we hope you enjoyed this one, and see you next week.